This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. We begin today's show by listening to my conversation with Irish author Roddy Doyle. He has recently been commissioned to adapt and update Mozart's opera Don Giovanni to be staged next year at the Dublin Theatre Festival. When he joined me last year to discuss his novel Guts, he described the challenges of reworking his writing into a musical form. He's done this with his most famous work, The Commitments, about a hardscrabble Irish soul band. Let's take a listen.
Before you became a novelist, you did work in a school. You were a teacher.
Yeah, I did the two. I actually started writing when I was teaching. I was a teacher for 14 years, from 1979 to 93, and I'd published 4 novels before I gave up teaching.
Yeah, and you taught geography?
In the good years, English with a bit of geography. In the bad years, geography with a bit of English.
Oh, and good, bad years, meaning which one you like teaching?
It depends. I was a bit like, I much preferred teaching English than geography, to be honest with you. And then it being a time of recession, when a teacher left, they weren't replaced. So I ended up being a little bit like the putty in the timetable. So I ended up, despite the fact that I'd been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I'd co-written a script that had become a huge film, The Commitments, and I was still teaching away. I was teaching geography, so it was one of the things that nudged me towards the door, to be honest with you. But there was nothing they could do. They weren't allowed to recruit new teachers.
The Commitments is a musical. And are you surprised did you watch musicals as a kid growing up?
No, it wouldn't have been high on my list of things to do at all, you know.
That kind of music?
No, or that presentation. I suppose, you know, when in our house, if the Sound of Music is on, all males, including the dog, stand up and leave the room.
Just too treacly for you.
Just leaving the mother, a daughter, and another dog watching the Sound of Music.
Crying,
yeah. So, no, it was never a big love of mine. But as my children got older, I used to, when the boys and then my daughter, it became a sort of a once or twice a year habit. We'd go across to London, go to a football match maybe in the afternoon, and then go to a show. Huh. And it began to open my head to the whole idea, because some of them are brilliant, you know, really, really great. Billy Elliot, I thought, was an amazing show. And the producers, I was wondering, you know.
Oh, sure.
I was wary of the producers. I was worried that they were going to ruin a really, really good film. And actually, it's great. So these sort of things nudged me towards the notion. Yeah. They'd always been interested in the stage musical rights. And I'd said, no. I thought as well, with The Commitments, enough is enough. But as I got older and I distanced myself from that time, I felt more relaxed about it. So I had no intention of writing the script for the stage version, but I ended up doing it.
Did you like it?
I had a great time. Oh. I had a great time.
It's different than this kind of writing in a novel?
Very, very different, yeah. And even choosing the songs to go into it, the need for songs is different. You know, you need a song that somehow propels the story, and the band can go in some state during the song and come out in a different state, perhaps more proficient at the other end of it. So it was a great, great experience. The whole writing of it, even the anxiety of not getting the rights for certain songs and having to do quick rewrites and wondering, will we get the rights for this song? Nerve-wracking. But I suppose because it all ended happily ever after, like a Julie Garland, you know, we put on the show anyway movie, it was a terrific experience. And I went to London then for the guts of 3 months at rehearsals, you know, and that was frantic as well, you know. So as I decided some time ago that, you know, essentially I'm a novelist, but I decided that if the opportunity was ever plonked in front of me to do something that was almost like, in a childish way, a once-in-a-lifetime experience, I'd have a bash, and this is one of those. I'm delighted I did it. So it's doing quite well now in London, yeah.
I ran across some Roddy Doyle's tips for writers. Number two is do be kind to yourself. Fill pages as quickly as possible, double space, or write on every second line. Regard every new page as a small triumph, .. until you get to page 50, then calm down and start worrying about the quality. Feel anxiety. It's the job.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not the only person who feels if I've started a new novel, when you get to page 50, you feel you've gone over a little hump and that you can actually say to yourself, I'm writing a novel.
Do give the work a name as quickly as possible. Is that something you do?
I try to. No, I have failed on occasion. I wrote an entire novel that was called On the File Novel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what did that turn into?
What was it? I can't. The Dead Republic.
Oh.
Which is actually, I find a great title, but it took... I was finished the book before I came up with the name for it.
And how about this one, The Guts?
When quite early on I came up with that one. I was pleased, yeah, to come up with a title for that. It's a bit like having a child, you know. You can leave it a few days before you give it a name. But, I mean, in the case of writing an entire book without giving it a name, it's like deciding at the age of 27 to call your child Joe.
One more thing. Do restrict your browsing to a few websites a day.
Yeah.
And as you say, you work at home alone, and it must be very tempting to...
It is.
...to go online
yeah.
somewhere.
My
There's
friend,
a lot out there.
I look at football sites, and I have a Pitchfork, a music site, so I kind of time them. But a friend of mine, Nick Hornby, the writer...
Oh, sure.
...he put me onto this site called Freedom. Which for 10, you know, it's that, because you should have the self-control to do it anyway. But it kind of, if you click in, say you want 40 minutes
yeah.
free of the internet, it won't let you go near the internet. Even if you plead with it and, you know, pray to it and, you know, lick the screen, it will not change. So it's a daft, childish thing, but that works, particularly in the late afternoon when you know that the time is running out. I just ban myself from the internet for 2 hours.
You also say do not search amazon.com.uk for the book you haven't written yet.
Yeah, actually, I think really staying away from that. Once, even if you have, if you are lucky enough to have a book published, don't start looking at reviews on Amazon. It can be very dispiriting somehow, and it can be very... It's distracting, but I think just get on with your work. You
Have
know?
You read reviews of this, The Guts?
No, I've read the print reviews. I've read some of them, and, you know, I think it's a way... You read the first few, they're very good, and I kind of think, well, that'll do me.
Oh.
And besides, if they're bad, you'll be told anyway. You know, I'll get a text say, don't read The Guardian. Whatever you
That's
do.
That's a good friend,
don't
isn't it?
Read The Guardian. Yes, probably another writer.
Are you off the air a profanities speaker yourself?
I am, yes. Proud, have a badge proclaiming it. Yes,
Putting
I do.
Putting all interesting words together?
It is the. It's part of the rhythm of the language that I grew up with. Not in my own home, although later on, yeah, when my father particularly would be telling us stories from, you know, back in the day, it was riddled with profanity, but not when we were young kids. It was the language we'd leave it on the step before we went into the house. Mm-hmm. But yes, it was part of the thrill of talking in the back of the classroom. If you were caught, you know, you were in big, big trouble, but that's why you did it. But then... Yeah, it's always been part of the rhythm of the language in the part of Dublin I've come from. And the challenge was to try and maintain that rhythm on paper, really. And I know a lot of people are shocked by it, particularly people from outside Ireland, but there you go. I mean, I didn't invent it. It has been described as a Roddy Doyle-type language, but I didn't actually invent it myself. But when you have a group of men, middle-aged men getting together, it's there. And the option is to leave it out. But the strength of these characters is based on how they speak, you know. And if I did that, I think they'd be far less interesting. And the rhythm of the language would be entirely different. And I would not be particularly happy doing that. So it's just there. It's in the air almost.
And perhaps it's this rhythm of language that if you could have been a musician, would you have been one?
Oh, yeah. Well, if I could have been a soccer player, I would have been one, you know.
But music is so important in your writing.
Well, yeah, I suppose with the first book being about music and this book to an extent being about music and they're the bookends of my career.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't really think I don't think it means any more to me than it means to most people. It just, I suppose, given what I do for a living, I use it.
Yeah.
That's it, I think.
Yeah.
And I work on my own, so I listen to music as I work. Depending on what I'm doing. So I probably spend more time listening to music than most people, certainly my age, you know, do. So other than that, though, I don't have anything much to say about that. I really love music.
But you never played an instrument?
I've recently started learning to play the trumpet.
Oh, sort of like your character.
Yeah. When I bought my trumpet, the man who sold it to me said, I was writing this novel at the time, and the man said, I bought it in January of last year, the year before last. And he said to me, you'll be playing tunes by Christmas. And on the way home, it struck me, that'll be a lovely thing for somebody to say to Jimmy just before he starts chemotherapy. So his wife, again, the wonderful Aoife, gives him this trumpet for Christmas and says that the guy I bought it from said, you'll be playing tunes by Christmas, which becomes a much more... It's a nice thing to say to anybody who's buying an instrument, but it's also, it's a doubly, trebly nice thing to say to somebody who may not be around next Christmas.
And did you learn by Christmas? Did you learn to play
I can play things badly on the trumpet. It'll always be like that. The dogs stopped. I have dogs at home, and they stopped barking in the fourth month, which must have been some sort of improvement.
Have they gone deaf or what?
It could be that. I prefer to think that the notes are better.
But why the trumpet?
Well,
for you. I mean, clearly, I understand for Jimmy, I think. But
well,
why for
me,
you?
And it's the only time I've ever used an autobiographical detail overtly, really. I apparently was snoring quite badly, and my wife was worried because I was sleep.
Apnea.
Apparently, I stopped breathing on occasions. I wasn't aware of it. I was quite content in the land of wherever. And but she was a bit worried about it, and she did a bit of Googling. And somewhere or other, there was something that suggested that if you learn how to play a brass instrument, it is very, very good lung exercise and stops the snoring. So I was happy enough to... We were at the movies in an art house cinema in Dublin, and there was a music shop right beside it, so I went straight in and we bought a trumpet. And so I started learning quite soon after that. I do a lesson once a week.
And did it help your sleep or your snoring or you're not breathing while you're sleeping?
I don't know. Apparently, I get the odd kick while I'm asleep, so I must still be snoring, but perhaps not as badly as I used to.
And is there Trumpet for Dummies?
I'm sure there is. I haven't gone for it. Another, I wrote a book for children called Wilderness, and there were huskies in that. And there is Siberian Huskies for Dummies because I have that one at home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But you have a writing program for kids called Fighting Words.
Yeah. Inspired by an American program founded by Dave Eggers, 826 Valencia. And that's one does 826 Brooklyn. There may be one in Philadelphia. I'm not sure. But I went and visited the one in San Francisco, and it was just a fantastic way of, you know, inviting kids to write and making it, I'm wary of the word fun, but making it, accessible and making it doable. There's no mystery to it. You just sit and
you write.
You
just write, right?
Yeah.
You write together, you write.
Yeah, it's a great way to get them. I work with teenagers mostly, and, you know, if you get them writing together onto a big screen, it's a little bit of theatre, actually, you know. And then if they've a bit of dialogue on the screen, they start working on it, giving the characters names, deciding whether to write in the past or the present tense, where it is. And then gradually they go away and they start working by themselves. But it's a great way to introduce them to the whole idea that, you know, when they see the words and they didn't have to go through the labour, the anxiety of wondering, did I spell it right? Should there be a full stop? And when you lift that from them for just a while, it is a great experience. It's hugely enjoyable. But it also works, I think, in a lot of cases.
That was my 2014 interview with Irish author Roddy Doyle. He was commissioned to create an updated version of the opera Don Giovanni. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from actress, dancer, and singer Rita Moreno. Stay with us.
Tell you a story.
Every man ought to know.
If you want a little loving, you gotta start real slow. She's gonna love you tonight now. If you just treat her right.
America. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Rita Moreno will forever be most recognizable for her role as Anita in the film adaptation of West Side Story. But the 84-year-old triple threat has had a much more storied career than that one landmark performance. She's one of the 12 EGOTs. That's the distinction of having won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony Award. Next month, she'll be the recipient of a Kennedy Center honor, and she's just released a new album called Una Vez Más. She joined me back in 2012 to talk about her life and her Hollywood career. Let's listen. Can we go back to the beginning
sure.
of your life?
Yeah.
You were born in Puerto Rico.
I was born in Humacao, Puerto Rico, and I came to this country when I was 5 years old with my mother. We came by ship because we couldn't afford airplanes in those days. I mean, and, you know, my mom barely spoke English. I spoke none. And I think the most shocking thing initially about coming to this country was the cold.
Oh, indeed.
It was in February.
Indeed. And you went to New York, I'm assuming.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, you know what's wonderful? I got a gift last year of the list of passengers on that ship. Isn't that marvelous?
Yes.
And it has my mother's name there, along with other passengers. And it has my name, which was Rosa Dolores Alverio. That's a great thing to have. And we have, and on this wonderful thing, which I've had laminated, is the picture of the ship.
Oh, my goodness.
Which I have to amuse you with this. It was called the SS Carabobo. Literally, the meaning of that in Spanish is stupid face. I cannot imagine why
anybody would call
a ship stupid face. I've been trying to find out ever since then. And I kept, you know, when I first saw this, I said, Carabobo, because cara is face. Bobo is dumb, you know, dumb face.
Well, you showed them, right?
But it's not, you know, it's not a very good portent.
No, it isn't. But I'm also, you lived in Puerto Rico till you were about five,
yeah,
right? It was this a village, a town?
It was a little village.
A little village.
And it was a little village called Juncos. I have great memories, you know, joyous memories. It's a tropical place. There's the sounds are always birds and roosters crowing and dogs barking and people laughing. We're a very raucous people. and we what's lovely about it, too, because all these sounds and smells and it's beautiful. So the contrast when I was on that bus on the way to an apartment with my mom was so startling, and I was freezing.
And probably, I mean, you were, what, 5 years old. You didn't know the language.
We didn't know the language, and we'd had a very, very rough trip, a journey on the ship.
Bad weather?
Oh, boy. Yeah. We were delayed, in fact, because the weather was so severe, and which usually didn't happen. So we were already very traumatized.
Yeah. Where did you first live then?
In the Bronx.
In the Bronx,
In the Bronx, yeah.
In one of those big apartment buildings?
Oh, yeah, one of those huge ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the very dim lights in the halls and all that kind of stuff. Always on the fifth floor because that's where the cheaper apartments were.
When did you start taking, dance lessons, singing lessons?
I think it's when I was about 6 years old.
Wow.
Because my mom had a friend who was a Spanish dancer who saw me bopping around the apartment and said, you know, I have a feeling that Rosita has talent. Why don't you let me take her to my teacher, which is what happened. I went to see a man named Paco Cancino, who was big deal, Rita Hayworth's uncle.
Oh, my goodness.
Because she was Margarita Cancino originally. So it was.
There's a lot of that, isn't there?
Yeah, that was thrilling. And I literally made my debut when I was six, dancing in a nightclub with a Spanish nightclub in the village with my dance teacher, who was very short.
Well, and at the age of 13, you were on Broadway. You made your debut on Broadway in a play called Skydrift. Mm-hmm. Eli Wallach.
It was his first play.
Yeah. And I guess yours as well.
Yeah, right. And I've known Eli ever since. We've done things together. We did a play together. We did a movie about 6 years ago, something like that. It lasted literally 2 days.
Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's show business.
Yeah. The critics got a hold of it.
2 days. Yeah. I could sense the audience getting very restless during our scene because we were playing an Italian family where the son comes back for a last goodbye with his mother, but we don't see him. We don't hear him. And Mom is talking to this guy, and I'm saying to actually my older brother, I'm saying, Mama, what's going on? What are you doing? And I could sense the audience was very restless. They were bored. They were shifting in their seats. Very early instinct on my part, and they were coughing a lot. So I thought I would help the scene. I can't believe I did this.
What did you do?
What I did was we were supposed to be having dinner. And we were having spaghetti, of course, and I started to suck up these long strings of spaghetti to help the scene along.
Of course. And did it?
Well, people started to giggle, and the lady who was the leading lady, Lily Valente, grabbed me by the neck in the wings after the curtain came down. And she literally grabbed me by the neck and shook me, and she's my skinny little neck. And she said, if you ever, ever, ever try this again, I will hear about it, and I will find you, and I will kill you.
Wow. That was your introduction to Broadway, right?
No, that was my introduction to stay out of other people's business.
Yes.
As an actor, don't you ever, don't even move.
And upstage somebody else.
Oh, my God. She was ready to kill me.
But it was a very creative, bold thing for a young actress to do.
Actually, it was creative because I could sense that they were. But, you know, on the other hand, this has happened before and it will always happen where people get restless in an audience and you're still stuck with that scene.
Yes.
And, you know, what are you going to do that's really different to make people pay attention to you? If the scene is boring, it's boring. Yes, it was creative in a way, but I sure learned a lesson.
But did you think at the age of 13, my acting career is over since this play closed after 2 days?
Yes, I did. I did. I went back to my Spanish dancing. I did a lot of Jewish weddings, bar mitzvahs. I performed at those things, doing my little Carmen Miranda imitation and stuff like that.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, I know that you were scouted. Someone scouted you, I guess, a couple
of
years ago.
An MGM scout.
Yeah.
Actually came to a dance school recital. And, I mean, these people really went to these things in those days. And
had they heard about you or they were just scouting around?
No, they were just scouting. Like the way scouts very often do. They'll just go to a baseball game with kids and, you know, look for promising kids. And he gave my mother his card, and he said, the time isn't ripe right now, but I think Rosita has a future.
Oh, wow.
And MGM, of course, was my favorite studio because it had all the great musical artists, you know, Judy Garland, Gene Kelly. It was just rife with people like that. And sure enough, about 6 months later, he called and said, I want you to meet Louis B. Mayer.
So how old were you at the time?
I was just 16.
Just 16. And you had an interview with Louis B. Mayer?
Yeah, at a penthouse in the Waldorf Astoria. I didn't even know what a penthouse was. I'd never heard of the Waldorf Astoria, nor did my mother. We lived in the ghetto. And when we announced ourselves at the desk, they said, okay, yeah, you're expected, penthouse. My mom and I didn't know what that was. What is a penthouse? And we went to the elevator and didn't know what to ring, so we had to go back. to the desk. And
what
say,
is the penthouse?
I'm sorry. What is the penthouse?
Like which floor is the penthouse
right.
on?
What floor? And they said, "Dear, it's the top floor."
Yes.
Oh, I met him, and the most amazing thing happened. I was trying very hard to look like Elizabeth Taylor, who was my idol then, because there were certainly no Latin models at the time. None.
She was at least dark haired.
Yeah. Right. And. And I had my waist cinched in like her. Mr. Mayer said, she looks like a Spanish Elizabeth Taylor. Let's sign her. That was it. He had no idea what I could do. He was taking the word of a talent scout who said, you know, I think she's a fodder. I think she's good for MGM. And that was that. And about 6 months later, my mother and I went to California.
Wow. And where did you find an apartment somewhere?
We found a little house in Culver City, which is where the studio was. And that's where it all started.
Wow. And waiting for the phone to ring, or was there a part waiting you there?
They had a part for me.
They did.
I was there for about 2 months before they found a part for me in a Mario Lanza film. Mario Lanza was the Andrea Bocelli of his time.
Oh.
He was a big, famous, very popular tenor. And he'd only done one film before this one. This was to be his second. And he had made a huge hit in the first one. There I was, dancing with James Mitchell, who was with the New York City Ballet at the time. That didn't mean a thing to me because I had never gone to ballet. I'd never seen theater. I'd never gone to theater
really
in my life.
Had you sung before?
I sang on amateur shows on the radio, and I did some acting stuff. I did one of the Ave Maria Hour where I played Bernadette, and the Who Sees Visions, the lady in the cave. And it was hilarious because it was always filled with things like, but I tell you, I saw this lady with a veil. And they'd say, get that child out of here. She's mad. No, but I saw this lady with the blue veil in the grotto.
Well, we're sort of walking through your life here and working our way.
It's a lot of life.
It is a lot.
I'm 80 years old.
I know. We're going to try to shoehorn as much as we can. Just a couple of stops, actually, before we get to West Side Story, because you were in Singing in the Rain.
Oh, yeah.
You were in The King and I.
Yeah. My favorite movie of all time is Singing in the Rain.
Wow.
Not because I'm in it, because I had a very small role in it. But I think it's a classic. But, you know, I was thinking about that the other day, and I'm in a number of classics. I hadn't thought about that before. I'm in Singing in the Rain. I'm in King and I. Yes. I'm, of course, in West Side Story. And the other one that I consider a classic is Carnal Knowledge.
Oh, indeed.
Which was a groundbreaker, that film.
Well, we were watching that scene of you where
the scene
you play actually a prostitute
I'm
in
playing a high class hookah and it's
coaxing,
at the point, coaxing Jack Nicholson into how shall we put it,
an erection.
Oh, can we actually
think,
say that?
I think we can.
Yeah, and she's talking him into it because he's such a wreck at this point. He's such a terrible person. It's quite a scene.
But what's so fascinating is sort of the look on your face and the look on his face. And obviously that doesn't work on the radio.
The beatific look on his face. Because it's working, what she's saying to him. She's telling him that he's the king of the world, that he's really better than any woman in the world, which is what he needs to hear. Which is, it's just a frightful scene. And I remember I had a really hard time saying yes to it. I turned it down originally, and then Mike Nichols asked to see me, and I didn't even know him.
Yeah.
And why, he was so intent on having me play that role, I don't know. And I went to his apartment, and he literally talked me into it. You know, by the time he was through with this interview with me, he made me think that the whole movie revolved around this character, Louise. And in a way it does, but he did talk me into it.
Oh,
and my husband was not thrilled, I can tell you that.
Well,
he said to me, I really, really, really don't want you to do this, Rita. I said, but it's Mike Nichols, and it's Jules Pfeiffer, and it's Jack Nicholson, blah, blah.
Did he see it? Did he see the movie?
We finally saw it together, and he mocked, slapped my face at the end of it. But I'm glad I did it. I thought it was an extraordinary, very dark movie.
Indeed, indeed. And and a groundbreaker, as you said.
Well, the Supreme Court of Atlanta, Georgia banned it. It was not allowed. They would not allow it to be seen in Georgia in their supreme wisdom.
Well, let me swoop back, if I can, and even going back to West Side Story in this role of Anita. This is the one that won you both an Oscar and also a Golden Globe Award for your performance.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get that part?
With difficulty. I had to do what everyone else had to do. First of all, Jerome Robbins knew me because I did his only two films. And we met on The King and I. And it was he who brought up my name to Robert Wise, who was going to co-direct the film. And he said, we really have to see Rita Moreno. I think she'd be, great for Anita. So I auditioned with a scene, and I auditioned with a song. And that was fine. And then Jerry said, well, you have to audition for the dancing, because if you can't cut that, you can't do it. Well, I hadn't danced since I was 17.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was already about 25, excuse me, when I was auditioning for West Side Story, playing a teenager. All of us playing teenagers. And I went to dancing school and registered, and I worked every day from 9 to 10 at night trying to get my dancing chops back.
Wow. Well, you did.
Well,
didn't you say?
Oh, man. But, I had help. A friend of mine had played Anita on the road, and I said, can you teach me some of the steps? And she said, well, I can teach you a section of America and a section of the Mambo at the Gym. But she says, there's no rule that says that they're going to use those sections. But, if you want, I said, yeah. And as it turns out, they gave me the section to learn. Because, in a dance audition, you learn the steps and then you do it. The thing is, you have to do it with style. And not like they're brand new steps. So it turned out that the dance director gave me the section she had taught me for America and the section she taught me for Mambo at the Gym. And I found out later that Jerry was very anxious to know if I had made it, because he really wanted me in the film. And apparently what his assistant said was, she obviously needs some work. But she says she has vitality and she's got a great sense of humor and blah, blah, and a sense of style. But she will need work, he says. But what's really amazing is how quickly she learned the steps.
Not knowing.
No, of course not. Of course not.
I was reading that you had some complaints about the dark makeup that they used
for
the... I was
very resentful because they made us all one color. They used one color of makeup, and I was really, and I said to the makeup man, which of course was the wrong person to ask. He was simply following orders. And I said, why do we all have to be one color? Puerto Ricans are every kind of color because of the Spanish influence. My grandmother was a Spaniard, so I'm the fairest in my family. My mother was fair, too. And I have an aunt who is dusky, and not black, but she's dusky, and because that's the Taino-Indian in all of us. That's where my dark eyes come from, and my very curly hair.
Yeah.
And I really was very resentful, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I believe it was Jerome Robbins' idea. He wanted a huge contrast between, in fact, some of the Jets had their hair bleached, you know, as though somehow it wasn't enough of a contrast. So a lot of these kids had these awful bleach jobs, and you can really tell that they were bleached in the movie.
And did you get a lot of dusky roles after West Side Story?
Oh, not after, before.
Before.
I've been doing that all my life.
Right.
And certainly I don't mind playing Latinas, but I played every nationality that had dark skin. I always had to speak with an accent in movies in the old days. So to the point where I literally invented a universal ethnic accent for all the parts. I was playing a Siamese girl. I was playing an Arabian girl. I was playing an East Indian girl. And they all sounded the same.
What did they sound like?
Well, they talked like this a little bit.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't Spanish, because Spanish is more very Latino. You do know what I'm saying?
Yes.
But they didn't talk that way. They had this weird accent that sort of was, it just was in the ether somehow. You never quite knew what I played a Polynesian. And nobody ever said, you know, here, go to a dialect coach and learn this stuff. So I just assumed that I had to use accents. So they all talk like this.
Yo sé lo que son los encantos.
We close out my interview with actress, singer, and dancer Rita Moreno with the song Preciosa from her new album, Una Vez Más. You're listening to Radio Times in Review, and when we get back from the break, we'll hear from evolutionary biologist and prominent atheist Richard Dawkins. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoain. We conclude our show today by listening to my interview with author, evolutionary biologist, and outspoken atheist Richard Dawkins. The staunch Darwinian is known for never mincing his words about his devotion to science as well as his anti-religious views. In 2013, he published a very personal autobiography called An Appetite for Wonder. He's just published a follow-up memoir, Brief Candle in the Dark, My Life in Science, which goes deeper into his life as a public figure. Let's listen to a portion of my conversation with Richard Dawkins, recorded back in 2009. I know there's most scientists agree about evolution, but I wonder what it's like to be in this country, the United States, talking about evolution, especially with the public, as compared to England, the United Kingdom, where you live.
We do, of course, have ignorant fools in England as well, but they don't get political power, and I think that is a very important difference.
And you chose that phrase, ignorant fools, very carefully.
I did.
Is that how you see people who believe in creationism and intelligent design?
Not all of them are fools, but all those who believe in creationism and intelligent design are either ignorant or fools. It's no shame to be ignorant. It's not a crime to be ignorant. I don't blame people who are ignorant. I'm ignorant of lots of things. I wouldn't know anything about baseball or coal mining or golf. All I'm trying to say is that in order not to believe in evolution, you have to be either ignorant or foolish. You've mentioned President Bush. He's probably both. But the people who voted in that survey and who produced those shocking figures are probably merely ignorant, and it's not their fault. They just simply haven't been educated. Evolution is, I think, not part of the ordinary curriculum.
Well, it does raise questions about the kind of education that goes on in this country and students in England. Is evolution just a natural part of a biology course?
No, it's not. It's not taught nearly enough. In England, it tends to be taught rather late during school biology curriculum. And so if you don't specialise in biology, you may hardly get any of it at all. It seems to me that it ought to be taught very young, because it is the explanation of all our existences. It is why we exist, it's why we're here, it's why all living things are here, it's why all living things are so elegant, so beautiful, so complicated. It's why they have this uncanny illusion of design, which they certainly have. And I believe that even quite young children could quite easily understand it if they were taught it properly. But as it is, many people leave school without really understanding what it is at all.
Your book is about, it's the story of life on Earth, as you say, but it's told backwards. What do we learn about evolution and about life on Earth by going backwards?
Well, going backwards is a particular technique that I used for two reasons. Partly because I see it as a pilgrimage to discover our ancestors, and I think everybody's curious about their ancestors. You want to know what your grandparents were like, what your great-grandparents were like. And if you look up almost any surname on the web, you'll find that most of it's genealogy, people trying to search for their ancestors. But I had a more serious reason for wanting to go backwards. If you tell the story of the whole of the history of life, starting from the origin of life, 4.5 billion years, or 4 billion years ago, say, and if you tell it forwards and end up with humans, it's going to look as though humans were the kind of climax. It's going to look as though it was aimed at humans, which it, of course, wasn't. You could aim it at any one of, 10 million species that are alive today. But I wanted to concentrate on humans because my readers are human. If you go backwards, then it doesn't matter where you start on this massively branched tree of life. If you go backwards, you're bound to converge upon one singular point, which is the origin of life. So that gives the whole pilgrimage a definite target. I called it Canterbury because right. I had in mind Chaucer's Canterbury Tales right. from the idea of pilgrimage. It's an epic pilgrimage from the present to the past. And like Chaucer, I let my pilgrims, who are all the modern animals, all living animals, tell a tale or two. And the book is a kind of threaded together collection of tales told by these animal and plant pilgrims, not told by themselves in the first person. I thought that would be a bit too quaint. So it's told in...
You resisted that.
I resisted that, except in one case, the bacterium's tale. But all the others are told in the voice of me. But they're sort of a lesson about evolution or a lesson about life, which is appropriately told by this particular pilgrim.
Well, but if lions wrote about the evolution of life, the history of life on the planet, would they put themselves as the apex, the central point of this story?
Yes, I mean, it's worth thinking about that. I had a sort of...
I think
of,
you say elephants.
I said elephants and I said swifts. I mean, swifts would say that flight is obviously the acme of evolutionary progress and sort of the tree of life is aiming towards flight. Or in the case of elephants, the tree of life is aimed, the whole progression of life is aimed toward trunks. And humans, we are humans, and so it's natural to think in terms of our evolution, and that's the way I did it.
But I think some people who don't believe in evolution or are critics of evolution say, but if you don't put human beings at the, you know, at the center of life on Earth, you somehow are denigrating human beings and making us on the equal of amoebas and chimpanzees and dogs.
Well, I see no great objection to denigrating human beings. I think human beings do a fairly nasty job of running the world. However, that wasn't my intention. The fact is we are all cousins. It is a fact that we are cousins of chimpanzees and indeed amoebas. We are more distant cousins of amoebas. We're rather close cousins of chimpanzees. That's a fact, and if you don't like it, that's your problem. But denigrating, no, I have no wish to denigrate any particular species. It's not relevant to the truth, which is that we are all cousins.
You also write that there are controversies among students of evolution, about evolution, that there are controversies that are worth teaching in a science class.
Very much so. Any decent science has controversies because if it's an active science, there's a lot going on. And as long as the evidence isn't absolutely all in, there are bound to be controversies. In the case of evolution, we identified, I think, about a dozen major controversies. The difference is that there's a real scientific controversy. The advocates of different sides can sit down together, and they may disagree because the evidence is not complete, but what they will agree about is what it would take to change their minds. And that's the hallmark of a genuine scientific controversy. Now, as an educator in Oxford, as a tutor in Oxford, I set my students essays to write each week, and every single week, almost, they are asked to look at a controversy. They're asked to look at both sides, or all three sides of a controversy, look at all the evidence, go into the library, read it up, and then come to some sort of decision if they want to. That's for genuine controversies within science. Intelligent design is not a genuine controversy. No evidence has ever been proposed in favour of intelligent design. What they do is they bring to the fore what they see as weaknesses in the theory of evolution. Actually, they're not weaknesses usually, but even suppose they were.
They talk about gaps in the theory
of
evolution.
Gaps. So you identify a gap, and then here's the logical trick. You say, we have a gap in theory A, so theory B must be the right one, with theory B being creationism. By the way, there's no difference between intelligent design and creationism. It's just a political trick to get it into the schools. Theory A, evolution, we find a gap. Therefore, by default, theory B must be right. They don't even ask whether theory B, creationism, can explain that gap.
This article, you and your co-author argue that if intelligent design or creationism is to be taught in a classroom, and I know you say it shouldn't be taught in a science classroom, that it has to withstand the kind of scientific scrutiny that any theory or any fact or any idea has to be tested in order to stand up to the rigors of science.
That's right. Any scientific theory has to stand up to criticism, has to stand up to skeptical examination of the evidence. Now, as I say, intelligent design doesn't have any positive evidence at all. It simply looks around for gaps in evolution and then assumes by default that therefore creationism must be right. That's no way to do science.
You say some of the genuine controversies in evolution are things about adaptation, group selection, punctuated equilibrium, evo-devo, the Cambrian explosion, mass extinctions. For people within the field of science and evolutionary biology, this is what they argue about or debate about?
Exactly. There are vigorous debates going on about all those subjects, and they're fascinating, and students should certainly be exposed to those and, indeed, read them up in great detail and come to their own opinion. I mean, a student who goes into the library for a week and reads up on one of those controversial topics will emerge as, in effect, a sort of world authority because the student has the opportunity to really dig deep into the library and look at all the evidence on both sides.
Well, see, I think, and you hear from people that criticize evolution, that if you say it's a fact, then there should be no controversies, that a fact is a fact.
It is a fact that we are cousins of amoebas, kangaroos, and chimpanzees. There is no controversy about that. There are many controversies about the details, not of the fact that we are cousins of all other living creatures, that's not disputed, but of how evolution happens, of the relationship between evolution and development, of the importance of natural selection as opposed to random genetic drift, of whether evolution goes gradually and continuously or whether it goes in short jumps sometimes. Those are genuine controversies, but they don't affect the basic fact, which is that all living creatures alive today that have ever been looked at are cousins of each other.
Do you debate creationists or people that believe in intelligent design? Is that something you do?
It's something I do not do, and I thought long and hard about it, and I took advice from my late colleague Stephen Jay Gould, who didn't for the same reason. We didn't do it, we don't do it, because it gives a platform to people who are desperate, who are crying out for a platform as scientists. They are not scientists, they're not respectable scientists. To go on a platform with them and debate on equal terms with them would be to give the impression that there really is a scientific debate going on. I would no more debate a creationist than I would do, than a physicist or a geographer would debate a flat earther.
But by not debating it, it does allow, I think, a certain percentage of the population to believe that that creationism or intelligent design is a scientific theory because it's unchallenged within their world.
That is the risk, and it's a difficult dilemma. And some of my colleagues, whom I respect, take the opposite point of view, and in many ways they could be right. But for the moment, I have not taken that point of view. I've decided that the lesser of the evils is to decline to debate with these people.
But does it make you angry, though, that this is still being debated?
It makes me very angry that this is still being debated. It's a curious discrimination in a way because physicists don't have the same problem. I mean, physicists don't have to fight off this sort of snapping rearguard action from people who don't believe in gravity or something like that, don't believe in the atomic theory. And I suppose the reason is, one reason is that the Book of Genesis, as it happens, doesn't say anything about the atomic theory, and so physicists don't have to worry about it. But I do think that the whole of science is in the firing line, and evolution just happens to be in the frontline trenches. But I think that all scientists need to rally around to defend science, and indeed defend the whole objective view of reality against a sort of fantasy world which is enormously powerful in this country.
What about human beings today and evolution? Because human beings are capable through technology, through medicine, of changing our environment. And does that change then the relationship between natural selection, evolution, and all the forces that nature works on an organism?
Well, it already has. For the last few thousand years, humans have been interfering with evolution more or less inadvertently by artificial selection. When you look at something like a Pekingese or a poodle, it's obviously very unlike a wolf. So we have taken the evolutionary law into our own hands in those things, and maize cobs are so huge compared to the wild equivalent, and cabbages are so different and so on. Just in the last few decades, less than that, we've also learned to control the mutation part of Darwinism. You know that Darwinism consists of random mutation followed by non-random selection. Well, for thousands of years, we've been taking control of the non-random selection part. Now, with genetic engineering, we're able to take control of the mutation part as well and make that non-random as well.
Hmm.
And goodness knows what the end product of that will be.
Does that concern you?
It does a bit, yes. I mean, I think that any very new technology ought to concern all of us, because we never quite know where it's going to lead. It's not a reason for not doing it, but it is a reason for thinking very, very hard and not just letting people rush off and do whatever they feel like or whatever is commercially advantageous to them.
I want to read another quote, and this was you in actually National Geographic, and you said, "As an academic scientist, I'm a passionate Darwinian in the sense that I believe Darwinian natural selection is the explanation for all life. But as a citizen, I am anti-Darwinian. I do not want to see the ruthless callousness of natural selection taking its toll on human life and happiness."
Yes, well, if you actually were to naively apply Darwinian natural selection in human affairs, in human politics, you'd end up with, something pretty much like Bush's neoconservative utopia.
Survival
of the fittest. You'd end up with the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, ruthless competition, sort of Thatcherism, Reaganomics. So I believe that we should understand Darwinism. It is the reason we exist. It's why the whole of life exists. But insofar as it has any relevance to politics at all, we should understand it as something not to do. We should understand it as a kind of negative lesson. Let's try to build a society which, in a sense, is the very opposite of a Darwinian society. That's to say, a liberal society in which we care for the old, care for the sick, care for the disadvantaged, care for the poor, where the rich pay taxes. That's my kind of society, and that is a very un-Darwinian society.
And that was my 2009 interview with evolutionary biologist and author Richard Dawkins. The prominent atheist just published a new book, a memoir called Brief Candle in the Wind, My Life in Science. And that concludes this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.